Joy Davidman was a flawed human being, just like me, just like you, just like everybody who's listening to the sound of my voice right now.
Welcome to All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com. You've not likely heard of my guest today. In fact, there is a chance you might not even be familiar with the topic I'm discussing. Let me reveal the title of the book first, which will clarify things. It's called Joy. Well, the subtitle will clarify things. That subtitle is Poet, Seeker, and the Woman Who Captivated C.S. Lewis. The title comes from Abigail Santa Maria, and this is her debut release. But I'm sure it won't be her last, and when you read this book, you'll know why. Welcome to the show, Miss Santa Maria.
Thanks so much for having me. Please call me Abby.
Okay, I certainly will. Thanks, Abby. Well, now, I'll have you share about yourself in a little bit. Let's start out with this, and I'm playing the devil's advocate. Why does it matter who Joy Davidman was, after all? Do spouses of famous people really matter?
Spouses of accomplished writers matter, of course, because they inevitably, to a lesser or greater degree, influence the writing of their spouse. In Joy's case, she influenced Lewis's book, Oh Hell, that she read the proofs, and he thanks her in the acknowledgments, the English literature in the 16th century book. Then she worked on Surprised by Joy, typing it up and helping with edits. And of course, Till We Have Faces, it was an idea, Lewis's novel, an idea that he had been working on for many decades before he met Joy, but had not found the right form for. And it was over whiskey one night at the Kilns that they batted around some ideas, and Till We Have Faces was conceived. And then they worked on every chapter together. Joy's fingerprints are all over that book. And the Four Loves, of course, and A Grief Observed, we wouldn't have without Joy. But Joy also matters for herself. She herself was an accomplished writer. She was the 1938 Yale Younger Poets Award recipient, a prestigious poetry award here in the U.S. that still continues today. And she wrote two novels, Anya and Weeping Bay, and she wrote a book of nonfiction, Smoke on the Mountain. And she also wrote dozens and dozens and dozens of film reviews and book reviews for the communist Marxist magazine New Masses in the late 30s and early 40s.
Well, now, let me have you tell about yourself by virtue of also explaining how you got interested in doing a biography on Joy.
Well, I was working on my master's thesis, my master's of fine arts in nonfiction writing at Columbia University, and I was reading a lot of C.S. Lewis at the time and had, you know, for many years read Lewis, but was back digging into his work. And I read Mere Christianity, and then I read A Grief Observed, and the juxtaposition of Lewis's tone and demeanor and even the content of those two books blew me away. You know, in Mere Christianity, he's logical and he's reasoned and he's strong, and it's such a powerful, brilliant, brilliant work. But maybe if there's anything that's missing, it's kind of the emotion and the passion of humanity. And then I read A Grief Observed, and he was like Lewis. It was like Lewis was, you know, a modern day psalmist, and he was, you know, devastated and broken at the loss of his wife. And I was moved by how he talked about her mind being lithe and quick as a leopard. And I wanted to know more about who this woman was whose loss could shake him. And I loved the way that he talked about her mind and about their love for each other. And so I found Lyle Dorset's book about Joy, and I wanted to know more. I just wanted to know more. And through Lyle's book, I learned that Joy had attended Columbia University for her own master's degree. And because I was working on my master's thesis, I knew that graduate students were required to deposit a finished copy of the thesis with the library archives. And I wondered if that same policy stood in 1935 when Joy did her master's degree. I was writing in the library my thesis, and the cornerstone of the library says 1935, the very year that Joy did her master's there. So I went to the reference desk and I asked, and they typed something into the computer and they said, yes, we do have a master's thesis by Joy Davidman from 1935. And it was in the offsite annex, and I put in an order for it. And 2 days later, went back to the reference desk, and they pulled out this huge tome and handed it to me. And it was the very same typescript that Joy herself had typed all those years ago. And as far as I was able to discern, nobody had ever thought to request it. And this was in, this was either the fall of 2002 or early 2003. And I thought, if this is here and nobody's ever thought to look for it, and I'm in New York City where Joy was from, where she grew up and where she spent her young adulthood and the beginning of her first marriage, what else might be all around me? What other material, what other people who haven't been interviewed, what other letters that might be sitting in somebody's closet or attic or basement? And so I started looking around, and every stone I turned over, there was something there. And every person I talked to said, you should talk to so-and-so who might have known her. You should talk to so-and-so who was a friend or not a friend, you know, or a colleague. Or I would be, you know, I would call somebody up and meet with them, and they would say, oh, you know, I might have some letters from her in a box in the back of my closet. Would you like to see them? You know, and just one thing kept leading to another.
Even though we haven't gotten into the content of your book, simply called Joy, how is it different or similar to what's been published previously about her?
I attempted to write a real portrait of a real human being, a real woman. One thing I said to nearly everyone I interviewed was, my intention is to neither demonize nor idealize Joy. And I think that much of what's been done before has tended to err on one side or the other. And I really tried to take a more balanced, nuanced approach. And my book also goes much deeper than anything before into her pre-Lewis years, beginning with her family history, delving into her development as a writer, growth as a writer, her deepest internal longings, the facts of her life, the brief stint she did in Hollywood for 6 months as a junior screenwriter for MGM, her involvement in the Communist Party, her involvement in Dianetics, which hasn't ever been known or understood before. It was known that her first husband, Bill, was involved, but I found letters in which Joy herself talks about how deeply involved she was in practicing and studying Dianetics. So it's both her humanity as well as the facts of her life and a thorough treatment of her life story and narrative that I go deeper into than what I had seen before.
In your introduction, you note that you wanted to, quote, a more thorough look at pre-Lewis years and a more balanced treatment of her story. And also that Lewis stated, for those who have read in A Grief Observed, that Joy, quote, was not a perfect saint, close quote. In fact, she was, quote, a sinful woman married to a sinful man. Now, in terms of your book here, it might be say that you present a unsanitized portrait of Joy, and some may not like that. So why did you choose to do it that way?
I look at the Bible as a compendium of biographies written by God, who was the great biographer. And when God wrote the stories of his people, he didn't clean up their lives. He gave us these stories of the people who he loved in all of their complexity, in all of their sinful humanity, in all of their flawed humanness, in order, in large part, to show us the purpose of grace and redemption. And I really don't believe that it does anybody any favors to portray a sanitized version of another human being. That story, that perfect life was already written, and his name is Jesus. Joy Davidman was a flawed human being, just like me, just like you, just like everybody who's listening to the sound of my voice right now. I really believe that part of the job of a good biographer is to make some sense of the messiness of another person's life in order to help herself, himself, and all the readers to make sense and better understand the messiness in their own lives. And, you know, I so strongly do not believe in hagiography, this elevation of people into saints. I think it's sort of a problem in Christian biographies too. We all want heroes, you know, we all do. And, but a hero is not it's not a person who's perfect. There's just no such thing. So, I wanted to write about a real person, and that doesn't mean that I set out searching for her flaws. In fact, if anything, I didn't come to this understanding of biography and of humanity, of the importance of writing a humanized portrait, until I was starting to come across more and more flaws in Joy's life and trying to make sense of what do I believe and what do I want to say? What do I want to write about Joy? Do I want to really write her story and really write the truth? Or do I want to leave out things that are a little unsavory so that we can continue to have this false but idealized portrait of her, you know? And I wanted to write the truth.
Well, now, you touch on Joy's parents in your biography that I'm not sure I caught in other people's material. Tell us some about their background and how her early home environment shaped her.
Joy's parents, Joseph and Jeanette, were Eastern European immigrants. They came to this country in the 1890s as small children. They moved to the Lower East Side, and they lived in relative squalor in poor housing conditions and in what was called the Jewish ghetto. And they also faced anti-Semitism. And the way out was education and hard work and assimilation. And they both got college educations. They both became teachers. Joy's father got his PhD in 1917 when Joy was two, and became a principal. And he wanted to become a superintendent, but he didn't pass a school superintendent. And largely because of his tyrannical personality, which I'll get to in a second. But because of their desperation to fit in and to get away from the squalor of their childhood and to assimilate and to be accepted in society that considered them outcasts in many ways, they drilled into their children that because they were Jewish, they had to work twice as hard. And they pushed both their children, Joy and her younger brother, Howard, very hard to succeed. They gave them supplementary homework and tests during summer vacations. As it was, Joy was a sickly child. She had a lot of illnesses when she was a child, and that took her away from school for long stretches of time. So between that and the way that her parents expected her to study and to be an overachiever by doing all this extra work in her spare time, Joy didn't have a tremendous social life, and she didn't have the opportunity to really develop social skills with peers the way that so many of her classmates did. And I think that really shaped how she interacted with people as an adult. She's often portrayed as a brash, brassy New Yorker. But I'm a New Yorker, and I'm a little brash and brassy, and so many New Yorkers are. But Joy went beyond that. She wasn't a congenial person, and she wasn't
easy to get along with, even by the standards of New Yorkers. And I think a lot of that had to do with how her home environment shaped her. Her father was a bully. And I know this because Joy's niece, the daughter of her brother Howard, has many, many, many family papers and documents and letters in her possession that she opened up to me that had been sitting in her attic in boxes. And among those papers are many letters and professional documents having to do with Joy's father's career as principal, as a junior high school principal. And I found many letters of resignation from people who could not bear to work under him, who said that he ruled with an iron fist. And I was so struck by this because I thought if adults cannot work under him, cannot bear to work under him in a professional context and environment, what must he have been like at home with his children? And that gave me great compassion for Joy too, because she didn't have the luxury of the option to resign or to ask to be transferred to another home the way so many teachers under Dr. Davidman, as he insisted everyone call him, you know, were able to request transfers to other schools because they wanted a new principal. And so I was really struck by reading his letters, things that he wrote. He wrote many editorials to newspapers because he felt he was the only one who could correct the mistakes that everyone else was making. And some of them weren't mistakes. It was just he had a different opinion that he believed was absolute fact. And then he would be angry with editors who didn't include the letters that he wrote, you know, in response to all these newspaper articles that he thought were so flawed. So that was very telling to me, and it really raised a lot of flags and just told me a lot about what Joy had to put up with and made me understand why she sought sanctuary in the written page, in writing, and in reading.
In your book, which again, if people haven't caught the fact that it's just simply called Joy, you provide an interesting account of her finishing an undergraduate degree in her teens and then a master's degree by age 20. What are some of the most interesting things about these periods in her life?
Well, like I said, Joy's parents pushed her very hard. And one of the things they believed was that children should be educated based by grade placement, based on aptitude, not based on age. So Joy was 14 when she graduated from high school. She was 15 when she started college, which is extremely young by today's standards. But by standards of those days, most freshmen in Joy's freshman class at Hunter College were 15 or 16 years old. So it was much more common in those days for people to start young. But it was extraordinary for a Jewish woman in 1935 to be getting a master's degree. It was the Depression. The Depression happened. The stock market crashed in the fall of 29 when Joy was finishing high school, and Joy began college in the fall of 1930 at Hunter College in New York City, and she was there from 1930 to 1934, which was the height of the Depression. And it was a time when, you know, like most Americans, even then, even though it was the Depression, she was kind of living in a college bubble, and she was young and romantic. And at the end of her senior year in 1934, she was standing by a window, looking out the window, and she happened to see a young woman on the roof across the way of another building, and it was a classmate of hers, and the girl jumped and died. She committed suicide because her parents had died, and there was just a money problem, and she was desperate, and like so many other people during those years, she jumped off a roof. And
that snapped Joy out of the bubble, and that was a big shaping force that led her to think more about what was going on around her, the social and political context in which she was living, and what she might need to do about it. And ultimately, after a few more years went by and a lot of other things happened, she joined the Communist Party of the United States of America and became a card-carrying communist.
Next, I'd like to explore how did Joy meet her first husband, Bill Gresham, and what was their marriage really like?
Well, how exactly Joy and Bill first met isn't known, but they both were involved in an organization called the League of American Writers. Joy's poetry at the time heavily focused on Spanish Civil War and on her politics, and Bill shared her politics. He was also a member of the Communist Party, and he had also fought in the Spanish Civil War. He had volunteered as a soldier to go to Spain and to fight for the people. And this cause was central to Joy's career, her passions, her core ideologies at the time. So Bill was kind of a hero. You know, he had taken up of his own will. He hadn't been drafted, and he had gone over. He had fought, you know, for this cause that Joy believed in so strongly. And so it was after his return that they met, and they were both teaching at the League of American Writers, which offered some courses in poetry and in fiction writing. And the League strongly believed that writers had a responsibility to change the world through their writing. And many in the League, though not all, were members of the Communist Party. And it was a very, very leftist organization. Everybody who was anybody in American literary circles in the late 30s was a member of the League of American Writers, which began its collapse after the Hitler-Stalin Pact happened in 1939, and there was a big split. But at the time, the conferences were they had biannual conferences that were attended by everyone. Every, you know, great name in American literature who was writing at the time. And Joy was a very well-known poet. She won the Yale Younger Poets Award, and Stephen Vincent Benet mentored her, and he was a Pulitzer Prize winning poet whose name is not very familiar to people today. But so that's how very likely Joy and Bill met. And they got married within a couple days after he had been married for quite a while before Joy, but that marriage, he hadn't lived with that wife in quite a while, and it was just a matter of getting the divorce finalized on paper, which he did. And once the divorce came through, he and Joy got married a couple days later, and their marriage was very happy at first and for a while. Joy called him, quote, the mythical perfect husband. She'd never met anyone like him. He was gregarious. He told lots of stories. He sang. He was the life of every party. And most people I met who I interviewed who knew both of them adored him. Almost everyone, in fact, spoke very highly of Bill Gresham. And so did Joy at first.
Well, now, we're going to seemingly jump a few years ahead, but I think there's some aspects that will get filled in by virtue of the question in regarding Joy, and that is, what influence did Lewis have on Joy before they ever met or she even wrote him?
Well, Joy and Bill moved out of New York City and moved to Ossining, New York, which is a little bit north of Manhattan, and started a family. David was born in New York City just before they moved to Ossining, and then Douglas Gresham was born while they lived in Ossining. And it was during this time that Joy started reading Lewis. She was isolated from her peers and from her family. She felt very isolated living outside of New York City and living in the quiet country. And she had more mental space. She was less busy, and she had more mental space to kind of think about the fact that she hadn't quite considered whether or not atheism was true. She was an atheist and a Marxist as a communist, of course, but she hadn't really backed up those claims. And Lewis made her realize that when she read Screwtape and Great Divorce. Lewis was becoming popular and soon would be on the cover of Time magazine, and his name was in the air. So that was the first kind of way that Lewis broke through to her. And then there was an experience when Bill, who was a very troubled man, he had clearly had post-traumatic stress after being in the Spanish Civil War, and he was an alcoholic, and he had a long troubled mental health history of suicide attempts and severe depression. He was working in Manhattan, and there was one night when Joy was at home in Ossining with her babies, and Bill called her up and said that he was having a nervous breakdown and he couldn't stay where he was, but he couldn't come home, and then he hung up the phone. Joy was at home alone, and she couldn't go search for him. She didn't know what to do. She tried calling him back. There was no answer. She lived in terror that he was going to attempt suicide again and that he was going to be successful. She suddenly found herself praying. She had no idea why, because she didn't believe in God. Then she did believe in God. And then she realized, you know, why am I praying? She thought, why am I praying? And then she realized she believed in God suddenly, very suddenly, that something broke through to her, and that she called it a moment of grace. And it took her a while to learn what that experience was about. At first, she realized there was a God, and so she went back to Judaism. She started studying Judaism, and she started studying religions, and she wasn't satisfied with Judaism. She wasn't satisfied with the law, especially. It didn't seem to jive with her experience of grace, of not having done something to have that moment, you know, transcendent moment that she had when Bill disappeared. And he did not kill himself, by the way. Then he came back, and neither of them ever shared where he went, what happened. But that the recounting of that story became the occasion to recount Joy's spiritual conversion. And they both started reading Lewis after that, both Bill and Joy together. And Bill listened to Joy's account of what had happened, and he joined her in this religious search. And he had always been a searcher himself. So they both started reading Lewis and ultimately came to believe in Christ through reading Lewis. Joy goes into much more depth about this in her essay, Longest Way Round, which was published in a book called These Found the Way.
And of course, it was because of reading Lewis then that Joy became interested in possibly meeting him. And she had reason to visit England to do some research. But that first trip to England, what was Joy's real motives?
First of all, I want to say that for the full story and all the details, and for the evidence, which is all in the endnotes, people should look to my book, because I think some of the things I'm going to say are a little bit broad and general. And it took a long time to make sense of this part of the story, because this part of the story became very complicated and convoluted and hadn't fully been explored before. And it was also ethically sticky. Joy's marriage to Bill was falling apart. She first wrote to Lewis in June of 1949, and they developed a great friendship. He had many correspondents, and she was one of them. And she stood out as one of the more brilliant, well-read, well-spoken correspondents. But on Joy's end, you know, she was at this point, she and Bill were living with their two boys in Stattsburg, New York, in this grand old farmhouse that they bought with the money from the sale of Bill's novel Nightmare Alley to 20th Century Fox. And she was even more isolated than she was before. They were in an increasingly unhappy marriage, and Bill was drifting away from Christianity. Joy was not. And she had this incredible correspondence with Lewis, and he was similar to a couple of men she had been sort of infatuated with before, or in love with, or had crushes on, or however you want to say it, once in college with an older professor, and once with William Rose Benet, who was a poet she knew, and also much older. And as she had done for both the professor at Hunter and William Benet, she started writing love sonnets that were directed towards Lewis and filing them away in a file that she titled Courage. And she wanted to meet him. She desperately wanted to meet him. And she planned a trip to England. They had no money. The trip ultimately cost $900. She did have a story idea that she was going to research while she was there. But the real motivation, I mean, the real purpose of the trip was to meet Lewis. And so she did. 3 years after they began corresponding, she left Staatsburg. She left her two sons, David and Douglas, who were, I believe, 6 and 8 at the time, with Bill, her husband, and her cousin Renee was living with them at the time, and Renee's two small children were living there. And so Joy sailed to England in August of 1952 and met Lewis for the first time in September and stayed in England until January of 1953. She returned briefly. In the meantime, Bill and her cousin had fallen in love. And it's a very long, complicated story with many more details that I'll let people explore in the book.
Well, now, there's a lot of other details that can be shared. But, of course, as you were noting about people getting more information from the book, as well as checking your notes as well as to, you know, how you can make the statements that you do or reveal the information, how do you know that? But one of the things that we know, and it has been known, although not everyone is probably aware of it, but Lewis did ultimately marry Joy not once but twice. But first I want to have you describe what their friendship was like before either got married for the first time to each other.
Their friendship began, like I said, with the pen friendship. When Joy came to England in 1952 for her first visit when she met Lewis, Lewis referred to her as an old and valued pen friend. They had been corresponding for 3 years at that point. And the friendship evolved over time. During Joy's first trip, she visited Lewis and his brother, Warney, at the Kilns. She stayed with them during the Christmas holiday. She did overstay her welcome a bit. She stayed for longer than she was invited, and Lewis said, talked from morning till night, and he said the whole vacation was a shambles. He's told friends in letters that she talked so much that he couldn't write or think, and the friendship, you know, suffered a little setback there maybe, but obviously continued to evolve. When she went back to the U.S., the correspondence picked up again. And then she moved to England permanently with her two sons when she left Bill. That was in November of 1953 when she left the U.S. And she moved to London and began seeing more of Lewis. And then a couple years later moved to Oxford. The friendship just grew and grew and grew as she was in England. And she began doing editorial work for Lewis. She was somebody he talked things over with. She helped him move when he moved from Oxford to become a professor at Cambridge. She helped him get settled into his new rooms at Cambridge. And that was a huge transition for him. It was a huge emotional transition. And Joy was there through it. She was a support and a rock and a friend who was steady, and I think that had a big impact. The real breakthrough in their friendship, I think,
came when they worked on Till We Have Faces together, and that changed things. Joy helped Lewis write what he, you know, considered his finest novel, and he dedicated it to her. And then, like you said, they married twice. Joy legally needed help staying in the country, and marrying Lewis was one way of making things a lot easier, and he agreed. So they got married on paper only. He made that clear, very clear to his friends, the very few people who knew that they were getting married. And Joy continued to go on living in her own house in Oxford, and Lewis continued to go on living in his own house. But he would stop by her house, which was walking distance, and he would stay until very late at night. And people started talking, and, you know, rumors started spreading. And then when Joy fell and broke her hip and had x-rays taken and was diagnosed with terminal cancer, then Lewis married her again at her hospital bedside. And it still took him a while to admit that it was more than friendship. He wrote to some people around the time of that marriage that Joy clearly couldn't go on living alone while she had terminal cancer, and he wanted to bring her back to the Kilns to take care of her, but he didn't want her reputation to suffer. And so they needed to marry. And of course they were already married, but he hadn't told many people about that either. And meanwhile, Joy was writing to people saying, "We've been married for some time now." You know, it was clearly, you know, she very badly wanted a real marriage with him. She very badly wanted that. But it didn't take very long for Lewis to realize, once it became clear that he was going to lose her, that he was actually in love with her. And he said, "They say a rival often turns a friend into a lover. Thanatos, which is the Greek personification of death, is a most efficient rival for this purpose." So, and he said, "We soon learn to love what we know we must lose." And so it was really once he thought that he was going to lose Joy that he was able to fully openly admit to himself and to other people that he was in love with her.
Now, you had mentioned earlier about how Joy actually helped Lewis with some of his writings. I wonder if you might quickly summarize that aspect again.
On her first trip to England, she read the proofs of his O Hell volume, and he thanks her in the acknowledgments for that. And then she did a lot of typing work when he was in the final stages of his autobiography, Surprised by Joy. And so she did a little bit of editorial work on that. And then Till We Have Faces, the story of Psyche and Cupid had been something that Lewis had been working on for decades and had not found the right form for. And it was at the Kilns one night when Joy was visiting, they had a bottle of whiskey and they batted around some ideas, and the novel Till We Have Faces was born. And the next day Lewis just wrote and wrote, and Joy typed it up and she gave comments, and then they had this back and forth, you know, incredible collaborative effort, and became this incredible novel that has not gotten the attention that it deserves. But then The Four Loves, you know, Lewis couldn't have understood love the way that he came to understand it when he finally wrote that book, without Joy's influence, without the friendship that turned into Eros. And then of course we wouldn't have A Grief Observed, which was written after Joy's death, without Joy. And that's a book that has a tremendous legacy. It's helped so many people who've gone through loss, the loss of a loved one, especially the loss of a spouse. And it's incredible to think that if Joy hadn't come into Lewis's life, that the world would not have that book. And the world very well, you know, may not have Till We Have Faces, and The Four Loves would not be what it is if it would have been written. It's a huge impact, even though they were only married for a few short years. Joy did go into a remission after her diagnosis, and they ended up having about 3.5 years together in a real marriage before she died. It's an incredible legacy.
Definitely it is. Some people may actually think that you're trying to hurt her legacy. Are you?
No, emphatically no. And I'm glad that you gave me the opportunity to answer that question so emphatically. I am not trying to hurt her legacy. In fact, I'm trying to lift her legacy up, and I'm trying to give her due. She has not gotten her due in history. You know, she's been forgotten as the great poet that she was. And I hope to illuminate her as a poet and a writer and a thinker, but also as a human being, as a real, genuine person with the good and the bad. You know, they live together, and she was human. She was flawed, and as we all are. So by writing about her flaws, in no way, shape, or form was any of my motivation to be sensationalistic or to demonize her or to slander her or to hurt her legacy at all. I really believe that we do no one any favors by sanitizing our subjects as biographers, and that by making sense of the messiness of somebody else's life, we are better able to make sense of the messiness of our own lives and our own stories and our own journeys in this world. And I also believe that that showing her as a real human being is the only way that we can truly understand the purpose of redemption and of God's grace. If she was perfect, she would have had no need for Christ or for God, right? Mm-hmm. And so I have no interest in hagiography. I don't believe in it. I don't think it's right. And it's not the way that God wrote biography when he put the Bible together. And you know, I think that for every person, whatever your vocation is, you can look at God and you can look at the Bible and you can somehow find something. You know, if you're a physician, you can look at Christ as the great healer, right? You know, and there's something that we can find that speaks to our vocation in the Bible and about how God would have us work in our vocation. And for me, as a biographer, I see the Bible as a compendium of many biographies. And, you know, God didn't scrub clean the lives of the people he loved. He presented their full stories. And it's important that we see that, because we can't understand Christ and what he did on the cross and the story of redemption, the purpose of redemption, without flawed humanity.
Oh, very well said. Well, now, those interested in getting your book can obviously go to the usual places, but you have a website, if I'm not mistaken. Tell us where people can go online, what's there, or additional things that you plan to have there in the near future.
Yeah, my website is www.abigailsantamaria.com. You can find out, you can order the book through there, or of course on the usual channels of Amazon or Barnes & Noble or your local independent bookstore. And I'll also be posting events. I also have a Facebook page and Twitter at Abby's Tweets, ABBYS Tweets. So you can follow me at both places, my author pages under Abigail Santa Maria. And I'll be posting interesting things, maybe some things that didn't make it into the book. I'll be posting these podcasts on there. I'll be posting other interviews and reviews and interesting things about Joy and C.S. Lewis and about writing in general.
That information will also be in the show notes. People will have a direct link to that. Well, just a little bit ago, you were giving some summary aspects in terms of some of the aspects of joy that people not as familiar with, especially, and may appear to be somewhat controversial to present. Moving from that to a more general aspect in terms of your book, what do you hope regarding the book, again, that's simply called Joy, either a key point or points that you hope people will take away from reading it?
I really believe that reading and writing biography is an attempt to map and study steps of people who lived meaningful lives so that we can better understand and guide our own. And I think Joy's story has a lot to teach us about love and faith and embracing ideals that transcend our temporal lives. And that's going to mean something different for each reader. So I won't say too much more, except that I think that everybody can get something out of studying this life. And I hope that it will speak to people where they are.
Okay, great. Well, Abby, I appreciate having the opportunity to talk with you.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I hope you, the listener, have enjoyed my interview with Abigail Santa Maria. Her book, simply called Joy, is just releasing the first week of August 2015. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty, your host for All About Jack, a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. Be sure to check the show notes for a direct link to Abby's website, Facebook author page, and her Twitter account. I'll also have a link in the notes to help you quickly buy the book. You can find the show notes by either going to EssentialCSLewis.com or allaboutjack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the audio of each episode is hosted, and browsing previous programs is a little easier there. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. If you, however, go to EssentialCSLewis.com at that location, you can still get this podcast. Plus, I have a variety of articles there as well, including a daily fact, quote, and quiz about C.S. Lewis. I hope you enjoyed today's show enough to want to share it with others. Also, feel free to leave comments about the program online at EssentialCSLewis.com or at allaboutjack.podbean.com. A recent show to consider is my chat with Dr. Don King about two books related to Joy Davidman. I've recorded that in one show. One of the books is a collection of poems by Joy he edited, many of them previously unpublished. And then the other title I discussed with Dr. Don King deals with discussing, or they would call it, a critical analysis of all of her writings. An earlier conversation with Don I reposted not long ago is about the letters of Joy Davidman that you will want to listen to as well. Older programs include a two-part show with Dr. Bruce Edwards about the four-volume set C.S. Lewis, Life, Works, and Legacy. And another older show from several months back is with Dr. David Downing about the Pilgrim's Regress, Wade Annotated Edition. Again, you can hear those and other programs by either going to EssentialCSLewis.com or AllaboutJack.podbean.com. If you have questions or comments, email them to info@EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, that's info@EssentialCSLewis.com.